This is Conversations on Healthcare. I'm Mark Maselli.
And I'm Margaret Flint.
Well, Margaret, the countdown is on. The switch to ICD-10 coding in healthcare takes place October 1st, and a lot of medical practices are scrambling right now.
The much-anticipated and long-delayed switch from ICD-9 to ICD-10 codes has generated a lot of anxiety for many practices as it significantly shifts how billions of dollars in medical claims are calculated and billed every day. I think some people were still hoping for a last-minute delay, but that's not likely to happen. And mostly, I think people are prepared this time.
It's time to move on, Margaret. And experts predict that most of the nation's large hospitals and medical groups will weather the transition without too much difficulty, but there could be some short-term cash squeezes as the billing codes are switched to this new, more complex but very important coding system.
And we always like to note that the rest of the industrialized world have been using ICD-10 codes for decades for good reasons. They're much more precise and they give us a much better perspective on public health as well as individual health. The information's more detailed, it's more nuanced, all good in the long run.
In the American Medical Association, though, long opposed to the switch, but earlier this year they struck a deal with CMS. Some health systems will be allowed to use workarounds until they fully upgrade their billing systems, and there will be a grace period before practices are penalized. There are bound to be glitches with a transition of this magnitude, but the change is coming, and it's coming very soon.
And I'd like to think that we're ready for it, Mark, but we will see on October 1. And change does seem to be the operative word in healthcare. So many changes in the professional landscape that's beginning to have a real impact on medical education, which is adapting to 21st century technologies and care models, and thus education as well, and really causing the medical education industry, if you will, to reevaluate how that next generation of clinicians is being trained.
And that's something our guest today knows quite a bit about, Margaret. Dr. Daryl Kirch is president and CEO of the Association of American Medical Colleges, which oversees over 140 medical schools. We're looking forward to that conversation.
And Lori Robertson will be stopping by, the managing editor of FactCheck.org. She's always on the hunt for misstatements spoken about health policy in the public domain. But no matter what the topic, you can hear all of our shows by going to chcradio.com.
And as always, if you have comments, please email us at chcradio@chc1.com or find us on Facebook or Twitter. We love hearing from you.
And we'll get to our interview with Dr. Daryl Kirch in just a moment.
But first, here's our producer, Marianne O'Hare, with this week's headline news.
I'm Marianne O'Hare with these healthcare headlines. Low-dose aspirin, a long-used preventive against heart attack and stroke, has been upheld as a recommended strategy for folks at higher risk of cardiovascular disease. Now it appears there's an added benefit. Experts determine taking low-dose aspirin regularly can help prevent heart attacks, stroke, and colorectal cancer, and the benefits outweighed the risks in adults ages 50 to 60 who are at high risk for heart disease. Exposure to air pollution, however, has an opposite effect. Folks exposed to fine particulate and aerosol pollutants have an increased risk for early death, according to a study done by NYU Langone, the largest study of its kind to date. It showed between 3 and 10% increase in development of cardiovascular disease and premature death due to exposure to fine unseen particles and air pollution. According to the study, exposure to this type of pollution is particularly lethal because it can easily slip through the lungs into the bloodstream. They say they'll continue to analyze which airborne chemical pollutants are most harmful to human health. We're heading into flu season, and statistics aren't what they should be for older folks, that is. According to a recent study, 3 out of 4 older Americans over 60 fail to get their shingles shot. Only 65% of adults get the flu shot, and 60% receive a pneumonia vaccine. Upwards of 49,000 Americans can die from flu complications in any given year, according to most recent statistics. Study shows that money is a hurdle for both patients and providers and needs to be addressed. And pot use and teens. A recent Johns Hopkins study shows pot use is actually down among American teens, as is smoking in general. 15 years ago, close to 50% of American teens had reported at least some marijuana smoking in their past. The study showed a drop to 40% in 2013. But pot still outpaces other drug use in the teen population, drugs such as methamphetamine. But that has dropped down to 3% of the population from 9% in 1999. The study does note while teens are getting a stern message about tobacco and alcohol use, they're still not getting the message about the impact of marijuana. And observers fear there'll be an uptick in marijuana abuse in states like Colorado and Oregon, where it's now much more readily available. I'm Marianne O'Hare with these healthcare headlines.
We're speaking today with Dr. Darrell Kirch, president and CEO of the Association of American Medical Colleges, which represents all accredited U.S. medical schools. Dr. Kirch served as the dean of the medical school and CEO of Hershey Medical Center at Penn State, and before that, as dean of the medical school at the Medical College of Georgia. A psychiatrist and neuroscientist, he served as acting scientific director at the National Institute of Mental Health. He's a member of the American Psychiatric Association, American College of Psychiatrists, and the American Medical Association. He has earned numerous awards for his work, including the Outstanding Service Medal of the United States Public Health Service, and he earned his MA and BA and MD at the University of Colorado. Dr. Kirch, welcome to Conversations on Healthcare.
Thank you so much. It's a pleasure.
You know, they say we happen to have both the blessings and the curse of all of the transformations that are going on in the healthcare spectrum. And part of your work is really translating that into graduate medical education. You know, in a recent speech to your colleagues, you suggested that the world of medical education must be focused in on resilience during this critical juncture in healthcare. I'm wondering if you could share with our listeners some of the more dramatic challenges your organization's focusing in, and why the focus on resilience?
Certainly, you could argue that change is always going on in healthcare, but I feel, and many of my colleagues feel, that the rapidity of advancing science together with all the demand to develop new models for delivering care and financing healthcare, together with the need to prepare a workforce that's ready to work in that new environment, is an unprecedented amount of change. And the reality is, unfortunately, the data show that a lot of physicians are experiencing what we would call burnout in the face of that. In fact, there was a study published in, I think it was 2012, and they did a survey of a large number of physicians. Over 45% were experiencing symptoms of burnout. And then what concerned me even more deeply when I read this study was they also asked screening questions for depression, and over 40% screened positive for depression.
Wow.
And then the most chilling concern, in my view, was that 7% of these randomly suggested physicians reported that they'd had suicidal thoughts. So there is an inescapable conclusion here that the amount of change, the rapidity of change, is creating tremendous feelings of burnout, depression, and worse for our colleagues. I think that physicians come to medicine and prove that they are resilient people. But I think all this change has caused for many of them their resilience to fade into the background. So what I emphasized in the talk you reference is the importance of cultivating their own inherent resilience, remembering why they came to medicine in the first place, developing stronger networks of support among their colleagues. And we're putting a lot of our energy into working on that topic.
Well, I'm not sure I've ever heard a more clarion call also for the development of a team culture in healthcare. As we look at the demands on time, on data, new ways of managing patients across time, and then all of the new technologies. And when you now think about taking everything that you've learned in those very sobering statistics and applying it to the training of the healthcare professions, and in your case specifically, of medical students, how do you look at modifying the training to a new reality so that people are prepared for this very different healthcare system than the one that existed even 10 years ago?
this is a profound cultural shift. Decades ago, when I was a medical student, the emphasis was on me as an individual and on my accumulation of fact-based knowledge. Mm-hmm. All the teaching was pointed toward that. But now what we're realizing in medical education and training is that there are competencies beyond your sheer medical knowledge that are equally important. And so when you visit medical schools, as I do, you see a lot of emphasis on patient care and skills like communication. You see a lot of attention to working within complex systems, which is what hospitals and clinics really are. A lot of emphasis on continuous learning, that you're never a finished product. And also, one of the key competencies we feel is the ability to work in interprofessional teams. Physicians of my generation were taught how to be independent practitioners. Now, we're all interdependent, and it's not just one medical specialty with another. The interdependence is with our nursing colleagues, our pharmacy colleagues, and others. That's a huge culture shift. For today's students, as you pointed out, they haven't known that old, mm-hmm. old culture. Mm-hmm. So I find a lot of energy and excitement among people in medical school and residency training today when they see the kind of mutual support that they can give each other and how much these teams can accomplish compared to what a single individual can accomplish for our patients.
Well, it seems that we're going to have to rely a lot on the interprofessional collaboration. If the numbers are true that your organization has done an analysis of and others, as well as that we seem to have a physician shortage looming on the horizon, some 50,000 to 90,000 physicians by 2025. And you noted at a recent talk that you gave at the Aspen Institute that the solution is simply not going to be found with more nurse practitioners, though that's one way that we can address the shortage. But there's seems to be a lack of funding support for residencies. And I wonder if you could sort of elaborate for our listeners some of the strategies that you're working on and the association's working on to create more sustainable funding residencies to meet some of the pent-up demand that's out there.
Right. The bottom line is that the American population is not only growing, but it is aging. 10,000 baby boomers turn 65 every day. That is automatically guaranteeing that we face a need for increased health care. The people who offer single solutions, use more nurse practitioners or other strategies, are ignoring the complexity of the problem. We feel that this is an all-hands-on-deck problem. We definitely need to use other practitioners more carefully. We need to adopt new care models. We need to drive unnecessary testing and treatment out of the system. But even if we do those things, we are concerned that we will face shortages. The major funding source for residency training in this country comes from funds drawn from Medicare. And unfortunately, those funds have been frozen mm-hmm. at the same level since 1997. We have been advocating very strongly for increasing the amount of those funds. And in fact, there are bills sitting now in both the House and the Senate that could do just that. The other things we also advocate for are programs like the National Health Service Corps that offers scholarship support mm-hmm. in return for service in underserved areas. We feel that this is a looming crisis and that there need to be solutions coming from multiple fronts. We don't have doctors freeze-dried on a shelf that we can draw on when the crisis hits. It's a long pipeline to create mm-hmm. doctors, and we need to be building that pipeline now.
Mm-hmm. Certainly diversity in the healthcare workforce is an area that we also hear much discussion. I know a number of medical schools are looking at innovative ways to attract more minority group members into medicine. And there are other medical schools seeking to attract students from non-traditional pre-med majors, the so-called HUMEDs, the humanities students who are able to transition into medical school without a strong background in the sciences. And the MCATs have undergone some major revisions to ensure a more robust set of competencies for incoming medical students. How do you see them facilitating a different crop of medical students and physicians who can really meet these evolving health challenges we've been talking about?
We know, the evidence is clear, that minority populations in our country experience worse health status on multiple indicators of their health. And we also know that people from those own minority communities who become physicians are more likely to return to those communities, work with those patients, and address those health disparities. So from our perspective, this isn't a political issue. It's diversity in the workforce becomes very much a healthcare outcomes issue. Socioeconomic factors are equally important in determining what our health is like. Traditionally, medicine, and especially our own AMC MCAT test, focused on the physical sciences, things like organic chemistry, physics, and the like. The exam has undergone a major revision this year to include the social and the behavioral sciences. Mm-hmm. This has been very well received, especially by patient groups that I speak with. They want physicians who have a broad perspective on their context, more than just their biochemical and genetic makeup. And so we're trying to broaden the perspective at the very beginning of the pipeline with the tests that students take as they apply to medical school. When I went to medical school, actually, I came from a humanities background. I was a philosophy major, but I was a rarity. Now we're already seeing more and more students come from those kinds of backgrounds, feeling that medicine is more than just the equations and chemical formulas, and that the human side of medicine is equally important. Mm-hmm. I think this is a change that patients will find very, very welcome.
We're speaking today with Dr. Darrell Kirch, President and CEO of the Association of the American Medical Colleges, which represents all accredited U.S. medical schools and various other teaching institutions, including the nation's VA medical centers. You know, Dr. Kirch, I heard one of your talks probably about 4 years ago out in the West Coast, and you really talked about being a vehicle for transforming healthcare and the transformation of medical education. And I think along with that is the role that the academic medical centers play. And, you know, we've been blessed on our show to have a number of very interesting guests talking about the transformations going on at their medical schools. We had Dr. Dennis Charney at the Mount Sinai in New York discussing the major transformations to accommodate genomics and big data analytics into their training model. Dr. Gabriel joined us from the Mayo Medical Center, which was incorporating more remote learning models for medical students. If you could synthesize for our listeners about how we can take all this interesting transformation that's going on in a way that might help the rest of our systems benefit from the innovation.
The experiences I have when I visit medical schools are very gratifying. Every campus I visit has some innovation in medical education going on. So the role we're trying to play as an association is to help all these literally thousands of medical educators who are deeply passionate people about teaching and learning in medicine. Our goal is to help all of them create a national and even international learning community where they share these innovations with one another, where technological application or a new technique in designing the classroom, so-called flipped classrooms, where the students take a much more active role in leading their learning. We try to disseminate these through learning communities. The culmination of this really is coming up for us in a few weeks in Baltimore, where we will have an annual medical education meeting that at this point looks like it will have over 2,000 medical educators from North America and beyond. We've left the world where curriculum was a very static thing that was redesigned only once a decade, to now there are innovations that are breaking through in a curriculum literally on a daily basis. one of the especially gratifying things is how many of them are led by our own students and residents. They're so technologically savvy. Mm-hmm. They're so creative and they're so passionate. They're doing incredible things that are becoming adopted by their colleagues around the country. It's a very exciting time.
Well, we couldn't agree with you more that we take a lot of satisfaction from seeing just how excited our students and trainees of all the health professions are and how committed they are to really creating that healthcare system of the future. But, you know, in all the visionary work we're talking about, I'd like to get your perspective on one piece, a little more mundane, and that's what are we doing to teach health profession students or medical students in particular about costs? That suddenly is a area where we've been confronted with the need for so much greater transparency for the sake of patients. What's the thinking within the medical education community about really preparing the providers of the future to be able to understand costs, talk about costs, communicate costs with their patients?
This has been a dramatic shift. Historically, we believed that considering cost in healthcare for a physician was somehow even an ethical violation. Mm-hmm. But the reality is resources are finite. They're precious. And we need to make sure that when we're applying resources, we're doing it to the right person in the right way at the right time. Now the stage has totally shifted. The vast majority of our schools, when surveyed, in one way or another, are including education, teaching, learning, telling their students about tools to help them assess the cost-benefit of different kinds of treatments. I would underscore that some people politically push back on this, describing it as a sort of rationing. The reality is we have a huge amount of resources in the United States that we apply to healthcare, $3 trillion a year plus. The problem is they aren't always well allocated mm-hmm. to the places where they will do the most good. We can do a much better job of that, but we can't do it if we're flying blind, if practicing physicians don't understand cost and benefits. So this shift now is, I think, deeply embedded in medical education at both the student level and the resident level. And it's important. We have an ethical obligation to do the best we can for as many patients as possible. And that means paying careful attention to our resources.
Dr. Kirch, we're not the only country facing challenges in training clinicians, and emerging technologies like telehealth and online education is showing some great potential around the world. I'd be interested in your long-term vision of where you see medical education headed, and not just here in America, but in the global community.
I've been privileged in this position to visit with associations of medical educators, visit medical schools and teaching hospitals in Europe, Africa, Central America, Asia. And the world is really becoming flat, especially in healthcare. Information is disseminated so broadly. Not too many years ago, the challenge for the medical schools in sub-Saharan Africa was obtaining textbooks. Today, now the efforts have borne fruit to give them broadband access, they can tap into curricular materials that the AMC and others put online. So as there's more and more sharing of information, of curricular tools, learning tools, I think it's good for the globe as a whole. I think it raises the quality of medical education everywhere. All that being said, I think my observation is, in America, just as we're leaders in science, we are leaders in medical education. And it's still true that people from all over the globe will come here to seek all or part of their training because of the solid foundation we've established. Our goal as an association and the goals of our members is to be more generative and help disseminate that knowledge to the people who aren't able to come here. And I think we're in a real breakthrough period in this regard.
We've been speaking today with Dr. Daryl Kirch, President and CEO of the Association of American Medical Colleges, which represents all accredited U.S. medical schools and various other teaching institutions. For more information, you can go to aamc.org. Dr. Kirch, thank you so much for joining us on Conversations on Healthcare today.
It was my pleasure.
Conversations on Healthcare, we want our audience to be truly in the know when it comes to the facts about healthcare reform and policy. Lori Robertson is an award-winning journalist and managing editor of FactCheck.org, a nonpartisan, nonprofit consumer advocate for voters that aim to reduce the level of deception in U.S. politics. Lori, what have you got for us this week?
Well, we've seen Republicans misrepresenting Planned Parenthood services, but Democrats do it too. Senate Minority Leader Harry Reid claimed that 30% of U.S. women get their health care from Planned Parenthood. Not true. By one measure, the number is less than 3%. More than 106 million adult women visited a health care professional in 2012, according to the CDC. That same year, Planned Parenthood says its health centers saw approximately 3 million patients, which would be 2.8% of all women who visited a healthcare professional in 2012, not 30%, as Reid said. Reid's spokesman has said that Reid misspoke and meant to say that 1 in 5, or 20%, of all women have visited a Planned Parenthood clinic at least once in their lifetime. Reid, in fact, has used that statistic before, but that figure is questionable. Planned Parenthood itself cites the statistic on its website, but doesn't identify the source. However, a Huffington Post YouGov online survey from 2013 reported that 20% of respondents said they had personally visited a Planned Parenthood. That's not a scientific survey. Instead, respondents are recruited through online advertising, and they agree to participate in surveys. The American Association for Public Opinion Research has said that YouGov's polling method has, quote, little grounding in theory. And that's my fact check for this week. I'm Lori Robertson, managing editor of FactCheck.org.
FactCheck.org is committed to factual accuracy from the country's major political players and is a project of the Annenberg Public Policy Center at the University of Pennsylvania. If you have a fact that you'd like checked, email us at chcradio.com. We'll have FactCheck.org's Lori Robertson check it out for you here on Conversations on Healthcare. Each week, Conversations highlights a bright idea about how to make wellness a part of our communities and everyday lives. As the saying goes, music soothes the savage beast. And according to a recent study conducted by Queen's University in Belfast, Ireland, there's some empirical data to back that up. In a first-of-a-kind longitudinal study, children suffering from a variety of behavioral and emotional conditions who were exposed to music therapy in addition to traditional therapies had far better outcomes than those children in a control group that offered traditional therapy without music therapy.
Basically, it's about treating children with emotional and behavioral problems with music therapy in addition to normal psychiatric care. It's not a matter of them being given music or choosing music. They actually make music along with the music therapist assisting them. So the idea is for them to express themselves through music.
Lead researcher Dr. Sam Porter said there's been anecdotal evidence that music improves mood in children and adolescents as well as adults, but his study revealed just how effective the music therapy was.
Our primary outcome was an improvement in communication. Now, there were two very interesting secondary outcomes, levels of depression and levels of self-esteem. And in the secondary outcomes, we found a statistically significant difference between the control group and the intervention group.
Dr. Porter says in the group given musical therapy, it showed over time more interaction with their surroundings and a better response to the traditional therapies as well. And he says the effects were sustained over time.
I mean, that's one of the marvelous things about music therapy, is the things that it is not. There are no side effects. It is not a dangerous therapy to get kids involved, and it is a productive way of getting kids to improve their health. So it is just such a good way and a harmless way of doing things, so it's really satisfying to know that it's also an effective way of doing it.
The study was conducted in conjunction with the Northern Ireland Music Therapy Trust, which sees the promising findings as an incentive to incorporate this relatively low-cost, non-invasive therapy into standard protocols as an additional tool to enhance outcomes for the youth population, which often suffers negative side effects from powerful medications. A simple, targeted music therapy approach, age-appropriate and showing great efficacy in improving outcomes for young patients with minimal side effects and lasting benefits, now that's a bright idea.
This is Conversations on Healthcare. I'm Margaret Flinter.
And I'm Mark Maselli. Peace and health.
Conversations on Healthcare, broadcast from the campus of WESU at Wesleyan University, streaming live at wesufm.org and brought to you by the Community Health Center.